Blog Talk Radio.
Broadcast. This is Kyle Hunt. It is June 3rd, 2013. Hope everyone is doing well out there. I want to thank you all so much for listening to Renegade Broadcasting. If you'd like, you can join in the chat over at renegadebroadcasting.com. It is filling up, and it should be a loaded show, a lot to talk about. Before I get to that, just want to say that you ought to check out all of the different hosts here. It is myself, of course, on Mondays, Dana on Tuesdays, Lou on Wednesdays, Mike on Thursdays, Siegfried on Fridays, the Roundtable on Saturdays, and David in Texas on Sundays. I want to thank all of those people for doing a great job here and putting out very interesting shows. So if you don't know about it, some people, I guess, don't know how to read a website. But if you'd like to download the episodes, the easiest way to do so for right now is to click on the link below the show, the different shows, you know, where you'll see our faces up at the top of the site. You'll see a download episodes and subscribe with RSS link. And from there, you can find all of the different download links from recent shows. So that is the best way to get them. And if you want to comment on any of those shows, you can click on one of the host's images and go to their different archive shows, or just scroll below the chat and you'll see a listing of recent shows. If you click on one of those, you'll see all the comments. We don't welcome trolls here. Unlike other places, we are looking for intelligent comments. And yes, constructive criticism is very much welcome. Just don't be a jerk. Seems like some people can't figure that one out. Other than that, we've been getting some good attention. I want to thank everyone out there who links to the site and our shows and who uploads them to YouTube. You guys are all doing a great job and helping us in a tremendous way, getting this type of content out to a larger audience. Some people have had recent complaints concerning Renegade's stance on Christianity. That's fine. I'd say that Christianity has been very well deconstructed recently on this network. So what I'd like to do is keep the discussion going on a different way of thinking about the world, building up our mind, body, and spirit with something new. Well, actually, something very old, but new to our minds in these days, where our past has been hidden from us, where our myths have been distorted, when lies are propagated as truth. And that is why I was discussing some aspects of Wotanism on my last show. I didn't really get into it too fully, so I wanted to start out this show with some different material which helps to describe what Wotanism or Asatru or even paganism is really about. It's hard for some of us to always come up with a really concrete answer, because these people who are thinking from a very monotheistic mindset of the Abrahamic religions, they want something like, well, Jesus is Lord and Savior and the one and only Son of God, and trust in him and you won't go astray. He is our good shepherd. And it's such a simplistic mindset coming from these people with such a incredibly complex and convoluted and contradictory religion. And the thing is that though paganism has lots of complexity to it and is not always easy to describe because it relies on a lot of personal experience and personal endeavors and connection to the natural world, it really has very simple principles which I will be getting into. And first, I actually wanted to play some audio here of somebody who does a pretty good job of describing what he feels Odinism is. So just give me one second here. Here we go. This is Odinism, Our Natural Religion. Be back in about 5 minutes.
Is an organisation which aims to promote all aspects of our ancestral religion, which we today call Odinism. It's a nature-based religion, and through our observation of nature, we can better forge a relationship with our gods and goddesses. We must understand the cycles of the seasons, spring, summer, autumn, and winter. We are to truly understand ourselves. If we are to fully appreciate Odinism, we must understand that Odinism is a very different religion to the monotheistic religions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Odinism is not so much a set of rules which we're forced to follow, but a holistic religion which balances ourselves with nature. We're not separate from nature. We're a part of nature. And by observing nature, we're observing a primal truth. Nature is diverse and multi-layered, and so is our mythology. We have many gods and goddesses, and these gods and goddesses represent our multi-layered reality. The French thinker Alain de Benoist said in his excellent book On Being a Pagan, "Beware the god who cannot laugh." This is a very good lesson to learn. Odinism is a religion of purity and vitality. Odinists aspire to be like our gods. We learn from them, and they encourage us to become what Friedrich Nietzsche called the Superman. In contrast, Jehovah is a God who inspires fear, as in the passage Jeremiah 5:22. "Fear ye not me, saith the Lord, will ye not tremble at my presence?" By embracing the esoteric and exoteric aspects of Odinism, we can more fully understand the divine powers that are within us. Odinic teachings lift us up and inspire us to great deeds, and help us get rid of the fear and the guilt, while our structured ritual brings order from chaos and draws us closer to the rhythms and cycles of nature. Our greatest teacher is all around us. We can learn a lot from the study of nature. Find out more about Odinism by contacting the Odinic Rite. Contact details are at the end of this short film.
All right. That was from the YouTube channel Green Jackman, associated with the Odinic Rite. And it seemed pretty simple there. You know what? We don't really need the Ten Commandments or even the Ten Amendments. Because, folk, we have the Nine Noble Virtues. I'm going to read from some text here. This is written by Lewis Stead from the Raven Kindred's Ritual Book. The Odinic Rite lists the Nine Noble Virtues as courage, truth, honor, fidelity, discipline, hospitality, industriousness, self-reliance, and perseverance. It would be hard to get much argument on any of these values from anyone. They simply and briefly encapsulate the broad wisdom of our gods and ancestors. Courage. In virtually every statement of morals applied to Asatru, courage is listed first. As Stephen McNallan has said, courage and bravery are perhaps the values which the Vikings are best known for. However, despite our history, few of us face such turmoil as a literal battle for one's life. In fact, I believe it might be easier to manifest courage in such a situation than to do so in the many smaller day-to-day occurrences in which courage is called for. The most common of these occurrences for modern-day pagans is the courage to acknowledge and live one's beliefs. It is also, sadly, the one that we most often fail at. While we may often be full of the type of courage that would lead us to face a shield wall, many of us quake at the thought of the topic of religion coming up at the office, or a friend asking what church we attend. We won't offer easy answers, but we ask this. If you toast the courage of your ancestors to fight and die for what they believed in, can you trade away your religious identity for a higher salary or social acceptance? In an essay on values, there is also the question of moral courage. The way of Tyre is difficult to lose one's hand for one's beliefs, but Tyre thought the price worth paying. In a million ways, modern society challenges our values, not just as Asatru, who are estranged from the mainstream religious practice, but for religious people in an increasingly not just secular, but anti-religious culture. Values are also not in favor in modern society. Breaking or getting around the rules is encouraged to get ahead. Living honorably is simply too inconvenient. I think most people, Asatru or otherwise, find this repugnant. But the only way to change it is to have the courage to refuse to take part in it. Truth. The second virtue, that of truth, is the one that most led our kindred to embrace the Odinic Rite's statement of values as our own. Early in our discussions, we decided that no matter what values we chose to hold on to as our own, truth must be among them. It is a word that holds so much in its definition and includes such a wide variety of moral and philosophical beliefs that we were all drawn to it as a simple statement of what we stood for. At least one of the reasons we wanted to adopt it was the simple issue of honesty. As Bill Dwinnell said at a recent Sumble while toasting truth and honesty, if you don't want people to know about something, don't do it. Truth, in the sense of honesty, is essential to personal honor and also to any system or morality that is not based on rigid legalism. If one is to uphold an honor code, one must be brutally honest with oneself and with others. Truth is also the truth that comes with a capital T, the kind of truth that one talks about in terms of religion or morality. It's common to talk of different peoples having different truths, but it's equally important to remember that while we acknowledge that each person or people has their own beliefs as to what truth is or where to find it, there is finally one single truth. This is not the truth as we believe it, but ultimate truth. While we may respect other people's truths and seek our own, we must never forget our search for the truth. Like the Holy Grail of Christian legend, it may never be ours to reach, but when we cease to search, we perish. Just wanted to add in there. The Holy Grail is not actually from Christian legend, but from our own people's legend. Honor. Honor is the basis for the entire Asatru moral rationale. If anything comes out in the Eddas and sagas, it is that without honor, we are nothing. We remember two types of peoples from ancient times. Those whose honor was so clean that they shine as examples to us, and those who were so without honor that their names are cursed 1,000 years after they lived. Good Asatruar should always strive to be among the former. However, honor is not mere reputation. Honor is an internal force whose outward manifestation is reputation. Internal honor is the sacred moral compass that each Asatruar and God should hold dear. It is the inner dwelling at peace which comes from living in accordance with one's beliefs and with one's knowledge of the truth of what one is doing. It is something deeply personal and heartfelt, almost akin to an emotion. It's a knowing that what one is doing is right and decent and correct. In many ways, while the most important of all the virtues, it is also the most ephemeral in terms of description. It is all the other virtues rolled together and then still more. The best way I have found to describe honor is that if you are really, truly living with honor, you will have no regrets about what you have done with your life. Fidelity. Fidelity is a word that is far too often defined by its narrow use in terms of marital fidelity. By the dictionary, it simply means being faithful to someone or something. In marriage, this means being true to one's vows and partner. And this has been narrowly defined as limiting one's sexual experience to one's spouse. While I have found this to be great practical advice, many treat fidelity as if there were no other ways in which one could be faithful or unfaithful. For we Asatruar, fidelity is most important in terms of our faith and troth to the gods. We must remain true to the Aesir and Vanir and to our kinsmen. Like marriage, profession, the rite in which one enters the Asatru faith, similar to Christian confirmation or Wiccan initiation, is a sacred bond between two parties, in this case, an Asatruar and the gods. In order for such a relationship to work, both must be honest and faithful to each other. Asatru, although currently being reborn, is at its roots a folk religion, and we also uphold the value of fidelity to the ways of our ancestors. This is why historical research is so important to the Asatru folk. It is the rediscovering of our ancient ways and our readoption of them. Discipline. In any discussion of the values of Asatru, discipline is best described as self-discipline. It is the exercise of personal will that upholds honor and the other virtues and translates impulse into action. If one is to be able to reject moral legalism for a system of internal honor, one must be willing to exercise the self-discipline necessary to make it work. Getting back to my earlier criticism of society, if one rejects legalism, one must be willing to control one's own actions. Without self-discipline, we have the mess we currently see in our culture. Looking at discipline in terms of fidelity, we see a close connection. Many pagans go from faith to faith, system to system, path to path. Asatruar are much less likely to do this. The discipline of keeping faith with our gods and the ways of our ancestors is part of our modern practice. In this way, we limit ourselves in some ways, but we gain much more in others. Hospitality. Hospitality is simply one of the strongest core values at the heart of virtually every ancient human civilization. In a community or folk religion such as our own, it is the virtue that upholds our social fabric. In ancient times, it was essential that when a traveler went into the world, he could find some sort of shelter and welcome for the night. In modern times, it is just as essential that a traveler find friendship and safety. In our modern Asatru community, we need to treat each other with respect and act together for the good of our community as a whole. This functions most solidly on the level of the kindred or hearth, where non-familial members become extremely close and look out for each other. It can mean hospitality in the old sense of taking in people, which we've done, but in modern times it's more likely to mean loaning someone a car or a bit of money when they need it. That's need, not want. Part of hospitality is treating other people with respect and dignity. Many of our gods are known to wander the world and stop in at people's houses, testing their hospitality and generosity. The virtue of hospitality means seeing people as if they were all individuals with self-respect and importance. Or perhaps from time to time, they are literally the gods in human form. This has profound implications for social action in our religion. Our response to societal problems such as poverty, that's poverty, folks, not laziness, is in many ways our modern reaction to this ancient virtue. In terms of our modern community as a whole, I see hospitality in terms of frontier barn raisings, where a whole community would come together and pool their resources. This doesn't mean we have to forget differences. We must put them aside for those who are of our folk and work for our common good. A brief aside, I think the hospitality that is so evident in many Europeans has been in many ways their downfall in recent years, welcoming so many different strangers into their countries. Moving on. Industriousness. Modern Asatruar must be industrious in their actions. We need to work hard if we are going to achieve our goals. There is so much for us to do. We've set ourselves the task of restoring Asatru to its former place as a mainstream faith, and by doing so, reinvigorating our society and culture. We can't do this by sitting on our virtues. We need to make them an active part of our behavior. Industry also refers to simple, hard work in our daily vocations, done with care and pride. Here's a few concrete examples. If you are reading this and don't have a kindred, why not? Stop reading now. Go and place ads in the appropriate local stores. Get your name on the Ring of Troth, Word Network, or Asatru Alliance networking lists, and with other pagan groups. Put on a workshop. Okay, now you're going back to reading and you don't agree with what I'm saying here. Well, be industrious. Write your own articles and arguments. Write a letter to the editor and suggest this material be banned. Better than that passivity. Get the blood moving and go out and do it. That's how it gets done. The gods do not favor the lazy. The same holds true for our non-religious lives. As Asatruar, we should offer a good example as industrious people who add to whatever we're involved in rather than take from it. We should be the ones the business we work in can't do without, and the ones who always seem to be able to get things done. When people think of Asatru, they should think of people who are competent and who offer something to the world. This doesn't just apply to vocational work, but to the entire way we live our lives. It is just as much a mentality. The Vikings were vital people. They lived each day to its fullest and didn't wring their hands in doubt or hesitation. We should put the same attitude forward in all that we do, whether it is our usual vocation, devotion to the gods, or leisure time. Self-reliance. Industry brings us directly to the virtue of self-reliance, which is important both in practical and traditional terms. Going back to the general notion of this article, we are dealing with a form of morality that is largely self-imposed and thus requires self-reliance. We rely on ourselves to administer our own morality. Traditionally, our folkways have always honored the ability of a man or woman to make their own way in the world and not to lean on others for their physical needs. This is one of the ways in which several virtues reinforce and support each other. Hospitality cannot function if people are not responsible enough to exercise discipline and take care of themselves. It's for those that strive and fail, or need assistance that hospitality is intended, not for the idle who simply won't take care of themselves. In terms of our relationship with the gods, self-reliance is also very important. If we wish the gods to offer us their blessings and gifts, we must make ourselves worthy of them. And the gods are most pleased with someone who stands on their own two feet. This is one of the reasons for the Acid True rule that we do not kneel to the gods during our ceremonies. By standing, we acknowledge our relationship as striving and fulfilled people looking for comradeship and a relationship, rather than acting as scralings, looking for a handout from on high. It takes very little for a god to attract a follower, if worship simply means getting on the gravy train. We as Acid True are people who can make our own way in the world, but who choose to seek a relationship with the gods. In mundane terms, being self-reliant is a simple way to allow ourselves the ability to live as we wish to. In simple economic terms, if one has enough money in the bank, one doesn't need to worry as much about being fired due to religious discrimination. We can look a bigot in the face and tell him just where he can put it. It's also nice to have something in the bank to lay down as a retainer on a good lawyer so we can take appropriate action. On the other side of this is the self-reliance in the sense of Henry David Thoreau, emphasis added on the Thor by me, who advocated a simple lifestyle that freed one from the temptations of materialism. Again, here we are able to live as we wish with those things that are truly important. Religious people from all faiths have found that adjusting one's material desires to match one's ability to meet them leaves one open for a closer relationship with deity and a more fulfilling life. While our ancestors were great collectors of gold goodies, they didn't lust for possessions in and of themselves, but for what they stood for and could do for them. In fact, the greatest thing that could be said of a lord was that he was a good ring giver. Being self-reliant also means taking responsibility for one's life. It's not just about refusing a welfare check or not lobbying for a tax exemption, but also refusing to blame one's failures on religious intolerance, the patriarchy, or an unfair system. The system may, in fact, be unfair, but it's our own responsibility to deal with it. In societal terms, we have become much too dependent on other people for our own good. As individuals, we look to the government or to others to solve our problems, and as a society, we borrow billions from our descendants to pay for today's excesses. Most problems in this world could be solved if people just paid their own way as they went. And the last, perseverance. The final virtue is perseverance, which I think most appropriate because it is the one that we need most to keep in mind in our living of the other values. Our religion teaches us that the world is an imperfect place and nothing comes easy. We need to continue to seek after that which we desire. In this imperfect world, there are no free lunches or easy accomplishments, such as saying words on the radio. There are no free lunches or easy accomplishments, especially in the subjects we have set before ourselves. If we truly wish to build an Acid True community that people will hold up as an example of what committed people can do, then we must persevere through the hardships that building our religion is going to entail. We must be willing to continue on when we are pushed back. If one loses a job for one's religion, the answer is not to go back and hide, but to continue until one finds a vocation where one can be more forward and live as an Acid True should. Finally, we must persevere when we simply fail. If one's kindred falls apart because of internal strife, one should go back and start over, pick up the pieces and continue on. If nobody had done this after the disintegration of the Acid True Free Assembly, this probably never would have been written. We must be willing to continue in the hard work of making our religion strong, not just when it is convenient and easy to do so, but when it gets hard, inconvenient, or just plain boring. To accomplish Without striving is to do little, but to persevere and finally accomplish a hard-fought goal brings great honor. So, that is as a true Satru. Interesting name there. And I would like to go to another audio section here about this native European religion. Be back in a little under 6 minutes.
Hi, I'm Steve McNallum, and I lead an organization called the Asatru Folk Assembly, or AFA. Asatru is a native European religion, and in the next few minutes, I'd like to explain to you just exactly what that means. Asatru was practiced throughout Europe by many of the tribes of that area, all the way from Iceland to Russia, all the way from the frozen climes of Scandinavia down to the sunny shores of the Mediterranean. These tribes wandered, lived, fought, left their legacy, and honored their gods and their goddesses and their ancestors. Today, the sons and daughters of Europe are scattered all around the world, and we think of ourselves as being Americans or Canadians or Germans or Danes. But beneath these newer labels, there lurks an older and more essential identity. We are Angles and Saxons. We are Vikings. We are Hermundari, Chatti, Cheruski, all the old tribes from which we are descended. We have been Europeans for about 40,000 years. We have been Christians for considerably less than 2,000 years. Perhaps it is time that we took a look at the path of our ancestors, the way that they related to themselves, to the gods, to the world around them, and see if there isn't something there that can benefit us, real, ordinary, live human beings in the 21st century. In the 1960s and 1970s, many people of Native American ancestry started returning to their traditional ways. Part of this was expressed in political fashion, but other parts dealt with their innate spirituality, the ways of their ancestors. At about the same time, many people of African American descent began looking towards all things African, looking to their culture in Africa, their clothing, their food, their ways of relating with each other, and, yes, also looking at their African religious roots as well. Now it is time for people of European descent, not just in America, but all around the world, to hearken back to this older identity. Time to look again at the way, the spiritual way, that gave our ancestors strength and courage and protection and inspiration in a difficult world. It's not easy for me to give you any sort of a description of Asatru in terms of beliefs and doctrine in a short little presentation like this. But I do have some statements that I would like to read that I feel tell a little bit about the flavor of Asatru, how Asatru fits in our hearts, what it feels like. I have here 9 statements. Number 1, the world is good. Prosperity is good. Life is good, and we should live it with joy and enthusiasm. Number 2, we are free to shape our lives to the extent allowed by our skill, courage, and might. There is no predestination, no limitations imposed by the will of any external deity. Number 3, we do not need salvation. All we need is the freedom to face our lives with courage and honor. Number 4, we are connected to all our ancestors. They are a part of us. We, in turn, will be a part of our descendants. Number 5, we are also linked to all our living kin, to our families, and to every man and woman rooted in the tribes of Europe. These are our greater family. Number six, we are connected to nature and subject to its laws. The holy powers often express themselves in nature's beauty and might. Number seven, we believe that morality does not depend on commandments, but arises from the dignity and honor of a noble-minded man and woman. Number eight, we do not fear the holy powers or consider ourselves their slaves. On the contrary, we share community and fellowship with the divine. The holy powers encourage us to grow and to advance to higher levels. And finally, number nine, we practice Al-Satrun by honoring the turning of the seasons, the ancestors, the divine, and ourselves in everyday life. Al-Satrun is about roots. It's about connections. It's about coming home.
That's it, true. About roots and connections and coming home. Thought that was great there. This is really starting to come together nicely, I'd say. This faith that has always been so demonized. Excuse me, not demonized, as David would point out. Demons were actually the pagan gods. So demons themselves, in the common way of thinking of the word demonize, have been demonized. Paganism, viewed as being utterly evil, has it thus far sounded as such? Seems to be fairly straightforward. Pretty easy to understand, but perhaps not to practice. And it is very rewarding, but not in the way some people want. They're looking for the easy way out. They're looking to have, things gifted to them just for being obedient, not for standing up for themselves and for their people. As Stephen McNallan mentioned, it's about roots and connections. After my last show, when I did the small section on the Blitzkrieg, and I noticed that if you're going to look at a Blitzkrieg from above map view, it actually spreads out like lightning. And this got me brainstorming a little bit. And I was thinking about how branches of trees and branches of rivers and branches of the family tree look a lot like that structure for growth and energetic movement and spreading out like lightning, like neurons in the brain during a good lightning storm, a brainstorm. So with that in mind, I would like to forge ahead and start making some of these connections that will start to really piece things together in hopefully a way that has not been done before. This is very crucial for our people, I think, to understand their roots. So let's talk about Tyr. T-Y-R, something of a proto-god for the Norse. He sacrificed one of his hands so as to be able to chain up Fenrir, the wolf son of Loki, who would later be unleashed during Ragnarok. Tyr made that sacrifice for the greater good. Much like Odin made a sacrifice, losing one of his eyes. Tyr lost his right hand in the mouth of the great beast, that wolf, if you reverse Tyr's name, T-Y-R, you get R-Y-T, right. There are religious rites. There's the right-hand path. There are political rites. There are many different kinds of rites, but since Tyr lost his right hand, it only seems fitting that his name would reverse to that. When you're dealing with these very important names, always try looking at them backward, because we know certain people do read right to left. Tyr also has other gods from different but quite similar traditions who have some correspondences with this story. Nuada of the Tuatha De Danann is one such god. He was the king and battle leader of the Tuatha De Danann. He had a magic sword as well. And he lost his sword hand in the first battle of Moytura. He had to step down from his kingship because the kings weren't allowed to have any blemish. He was later actually outfitted with a magical hand made of silver. And when he had this magical hand restored to him, he was able to once again lead the Tuatha De Danann, this time against the Fomors, in the second battle of Moytura, where he died. So Tyr seems to have a correspondence with Nuada in that they both lost a hand, but in warrior cultures, this might be something of a common theme, because I'm sure a lot of people lost hands. But the fashioning of a new one makes me think of some popular culture references. You've got both Luke and his father, Darth, losing their right hands, their sword hands, in Star Wars, which is an incredibly loaded movie, and I might get into that maybe on another broadcast. I've got a few other more important topics for tonight. Also, Ash in the Evil Dead series, he loses a hand and has a new one fashioned for him. First, it's actually a chainsaw, and then in the Army of Darkness movie, he gets a mechanical hand, just like Luke and Darth both did. Interesting thing about that the movie, the Evil Dead movies, there's a trilogy there, is that the main character is played by Bruce Campbell. I always just thought it was funny that he has that name, and then the leader of the modern day militia movement, or the guy who basically started it, would be James Bruce Campbell. Is it James? Whatever it is, J. Bruce Campbell. And I played one of his audios on the last show. Not related, I don't think. But just thought I'd bring that up. Anyway, concerning the lost hand, some people have theorized that Tyr's loss of his right hand is what is behind the Freemasonic putting of the hiding the hand, you know, the hidden hand, putting the right hand in the jacket. Sometimes people can be seen putting their hand behind their back, perhaps also, so as to hide it like Tyr. And I'd have to say that there could be something to this, but as I mentioned before, a lot of times these myths get mingled in with each other, and it's hard to really tease them apart or see where the inspiration is really drawing from. From what I can tell, these people like Stalin, who can be seen with one hand in his coat, or Duke of Wellington, or even Napoleon, or Karl Marx, they weren't worshippers of Tyr, but hey, what do I know? an interesting point here. It's just if you put SA before Tyr, you get Satyr, which is a half goat god, and a half human. And if you stack an N onto the end of that there, you get Saturn. Oh my god, it's Satan. All right. Enough of that for right now. I want to go back to the audio here for just a moment because I have a lot I want to get through tonight. And I don't want to run too much over the 2 hours afforded me of live radio. Actually, this one's a little bit longer, so let's get this out of the way. I believe this is also from the Odinic Rite. And this is Odinism, an eternal faith.
Cattle die, and kinsmen die, and so one dies oneself. But the only thing that doesn't die is the fame of a dead man's deeds.
Daunting in a way, and what the rite provides is in its members, it will take you to the edge of this forest, and they will give you a map and direction, say, and they will teach you the way. But of course, you must walk that path. You must want to walk it. No one's going to carry you. You must want to attain a higher awareness and to serve your folk. With no folk, there is no Odinism, because Odinism is the very essence of the Northern Indo-European people. You know, it is intrinsically bound to them. And so, without this folk, without this people, there would be no Odinism. It's as simple as blood is the only thing that can really do this. You know, it brings people together like nothing else. You know, physical characteristics, shared physical features, shared ancestors and shared ancestral memory. I mean, these things are value beyond words, and they bring our people together like nothing else. And so it is for this that the folkish person stands and believes that it will found a strong community. And it does, it founds a strong community, we can see this. The folkish person also appreciates that it is not just about being proud of your heritage and your ancestry, your race and your blood. It is about justifying that pride. It is about making yourself worthy of it, you know. Our ancestors have achieved great things, and it's easy for us to sit back and look at these things with wonder and become almost complacent in a way. Whereas we today must lift ourselves up to greatness. We must strive for greatness today. As OR can only move forward and evolve if its members actively put themselves to the forefront of the organisation. If they bring their ideas to the table, you know, if they've got ideas, they need to bring them forward to the CG and to the rest of the membership. It's very important that we do this, because the members are the driving force behind our movement. And if they've got a good idea, they should bring it, and it should be considered. And this is how things such as Acorn Hollow the OR Kids Briefing, which is the children's magazine which appears in the main journal. You know, these things were ideas that people had because they wanted to help their children, and now they're as much part of the OR as anything else, like the Guardians and Prison Affairs Bureau. People wanted to see something being done, and they got up and did it. That is how we would advance, by people getting up and doing things.
You enjoyed that. I think it was very important what he said about really just getting out there and making things happen. If people have ideas, bring them to the table. This is what we encourage. Act upon them. People have been getting in contact with me. and expressing the desire to actually have a real world community where we could meet together, discuss things, perhaps even live together according to our people's values with our people. And Mike Sledge recently proposed the idea of having basically the pagan version, the renegade version of the Rainbow Gathering. It could be the Rainbow Bridge Gathering. Bring together a lot of like-minded people in perhaps a wooded area to really start to embrace our roots together. And things that that relate to our ancient past are very familiar to us. The music that our ancestors heard hundreds of years ago and thousands of years ago, it rings true with us. The natural world itself is very much in tune with our spirit, and that's why they play upon our desires to protect it, you know, using Al Gore with his algorithms to determine that, you know, we've got to all, you know, basically fork over our money to the Jews in control in order to save our planet. We really should be taking active steps towards protecting our environment and encouraging plentiful growth. We need to be a fruitful people, that is for sure. And all the pollution of this industrial age is very much killing our spirits. Another thing that they would like to do is tell their stories on top of our ancient ones. This is what happened with the story of Jesus. This is how it worked with Luke and Anakin Skywalker both losing their right hands like Tyre. Just a few more gods that have just one hand, their left hand. That would be the god of some Middle American god. I'm not going to say this correctly. Huitzilopochtli. Yeah. Hades. Also in the Greek mythology, the god of the underworld there was said to have almost or completely had his hand bitten off by the three-headed dog known as Cerberus. There are other examples as well. So something you can look into. Interesting, the one-handed god, the hidden hand. Quick point made by David in the chat, which I forgot to bring up last week when I was dealing with rune magic, is that at one point the Catholic Church would put people to death for using runes or even having knowledge of them. So that shows just how powerful these runes are. The National Socialists used the Tyre rune. It looks kind of like an upward-facing arrow on some of their military uniforms. Not too surprising. Talking about runes and such ancient, and talking about the ancient gods and our pagan inclinations, makes me think of a movie I saw in a book I read when I was young, just The Hobbit, where they bring up runes and the naming of swords and dragons and things that really harken back to the legends of our people. And this is why it was so successful. This is why Lord of the Rings was so successful. And I will be getting into that topic in just a little bit. And first, I'd like to read about the predecessor to the Lord of the Rings. That'd be The Hobbit. And this short reading comes from ThulianPerspective.com, which is the blog of Varg Vikernes. And he writes on it more than once daily. So I really do recommend checking that out. He writes, "The Hobbit is the first book I ever read of my own free will. It made a great impression on me. It had a mythological feel to it, and it had profound meaning, even on a religious, spiritual level that I back then was unable to properly understand. Today I see how similar this is to the story of the pagan initiation ritual, with a child, a hobbit, traveling into a cave, the Goblin Gate, and through a dark forest, Mirkwood, where he faces his worst fears, Smaug, and overcomes them. He enters the world of the dead, the Lonely Mountain, and gains Hamingja. The dragon's gold is metaphorical. The true gold is honor. Arum nostrum non est arum vulgi, which means our gold is not like the gold of ordinary men. Bilbo becomes a man. Naturally, I don't download films illegally, and I don't ever go to the cinema, so I had to wait some time to see the filmatization of The Hobbit. By chance, I saw the DVD in a grocery shop a few days ago and naturally purchased it, and finally saw it. Yes, I already know that films based on books tend to be poor, even if the books are superb, as proven by Jackson's The Lord of the Rings trilogy. But I sat down to watch the first part of The Hobbit with no such prejudice and hoped for a good film. It started out all right, but I quickly understood that this was yet another Hollywood production. And the absolute low point must have been when the party of dwarves, led by Gandalf, fought their way through the Goblin Gate. Oh dear, what was that? A parody of PC platform games from the 1980s? What was the point of those scenes? What relevance did they have to the plot? Because of my love for the book, I really wanted to like this film, but no, I don't. It reeks. This first part of Jackson's The Hobbit trilogy is an infantile comedy made for kids. It can please others, of course, but is obviously made for kids. The whole film followed the same pattern. Stupid, exaggerated, unrealistic fighting scenes, alias Hollywood fighting scenes. Gandalf saves the day, and then some sentimental talk before it starts all over again. The dwarves looked like idiot clowns. Gandalf is still played by a homo. It's felt not like The Hobbit, but like a story about a child shanghaied to help a party of greedy, ugly, and stupid Jews steal the gold of someone else. The book I love, and if I can find time, I think I will read it again someday soon. Oh, didn't read that correctly, I don't think. Tolkien was a genius, and I really don't need to have his work interpreted by some Hollywood team of filmmakers. My mind works fine, and the pictures it makes inside my head when I read books are always better than those in any film. The power of imagination is wonderful and should not be underestimated, ignored, or indeed be suppressed. When the pagan child entered the caves or burial mounds of yore, the often plain drawings on the walls were enough to create vivid images in his head. He didn't see just crude lines and drawings of animal-like creatures. He saw moving, living creatures, and he could even hear them. He saw something not seen anywhere else in this world, and he had to cope with the fear his imaginative mind struck him with when he saw these images. When the pagan adult lay on the ground under the clear night sky, he didn't see just stars, but the spirit of the universe, the breath and movement of the universe, the meaning of life. He saw and named the constellations that we still know by his names. He saw eternity without anything but his senses, and his mind to interpret their signals. Today we are too busy looking where there is nothing because we have been misled. Wonderful stories like The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings by Europeans are used to turn our mind's attention to absolute nonsense. And in the background, behind our backs, when we look the other way, Cretans of Judean stock work hard to fasten the shackles of slavery on our feet and hands. I'll save my money when part two comes out. So that was by Varg Vikernes, and you can find his work at thulianperspective.com. Excuse me, that's just thulianperspective.com. And I will be getting into The Lord of the Rings just a little bit more on the other side of this audio. And before I go to the next audio piece, I wanted to just say that commenting on Facebook after last week's show, Stephen, you can find our Facebook fan page on the side of RenegadeBroadcasting.com, but Stephen mentioned that in the Lord of the Rings series, there's the king known as Theoden. Theoden King. The Odin King. The Odin King was actually snapped out of his slumber by the works of Wormtongue whispering in his ears by, I see as something of another aspect of the Odin, which would be the Wanderer, which was Gandalf. So it was like the shaman aspect of Odin had to confront the old king aspect of the Odin King. And I'm going to play a little bit more audio here with a discussion of the Nine Worlds. Be back in just a little bit.
Theology divides the universe into nine worlds. Some of these are the realms of the different supernatural creatures acknowledged in heathen belief, while others represent areas of the world that were not well known 1,000 years ago. It helps to be familiar with the names of the worlds and their inhabitants when exploring heathen mythology. In typical poetic style, the ancient heathens described the worlds has been linked together by the roots of the great ash, the world tree. Because the realms are linked by the tree's roots, they are envisaged as being more or less on a level with one another, and not lying in layers like a wedding cake, as often depicted. The tree itself is a symbol of life, and represents the well-being of the world. It is under constant attack from four hearts that graze among its branches, and a dragon that gnaws at its roots. At the base of the trunk is Urd's Well, where the goddesses of fate, the Norns, make their home. They help protect the tree by coating its trunk with protective mud from the well. Other creatures said to inhabit the tree include an eagle who sits in its topmost branches, possibly representing one of the gods, as both Odin and Thor are linked to the eagle, and a squirrel who runs up and down, carrying mischievous gossip between the eagle and the dragon far below. Three roots extend from the tree's trunk. The first root reaches out to the realms of the gods. The first is the realm of the divine family of the Æsir, including Odin, Frigg, Tyr, and Thor. The realm is called Godhome, or Asgard in the Norse. Here the most important gods and goddesses have great halls and estates where they welcome their devotees in the afterlife. Next is Vanholm, which is Vanaheim in the Norse. This is the home of the divine household of the Vans, including Njord and Frey. Other than Njord's hall by the sea with its ship harbour, there are very few descriptions of Vanholm. I see this realm as being heavily forested and very natural in appearance, compared to the great halls and tamed farmland of Godhome itself. Elfholm, or Alfheim, is the home of the elf folk. I've shown it overlapping with Vanholm, as these two realms have much in common. And Frey, the chief god of the Vans, is also the king of the elf folk. Even descriptions of elves vary from godlike creatures to the numerous nature spirits that interact with the world of men. Middle-earth, or Midgard, is the world of men. The heathen theology that survives is 1,000 years old, so in the myths, Middle-earth is the known and explored area of the planet. This would include Europe out as far as the River Volga in Russia, the Mediterranean, including the North African coast, and Greenland, and possibly even Newfoundland in North America. Middle-earth is linked to Godhome by the rainbow bridge Bifrost. The meaning of the rainbow's name is uncertain, so I've not translated it from the Norse. Lying slightly below these realms is Dark Elfholm, known in Norse as Svartalfheim. The Dark Elves are ground-dwelling creatures who in many cases are turned to stone in sunlight. They are great smiths and often help the gods by providing wondrous treasures and weapons. Hell is the land of the ancestors, the main afterlife for the dead. Its name has been reused for the Christian realm of punishment, which suggests a place of torment which is not deserved in this case. Hell is a place of rest, where the spirits of menfolk can recover from the trials of their lives before being reborn again in Middle-earth. There is one area of hell reserved for the punishment of wrongdoers, which is called Deathshore. Here oathbreakers and murderers spend their afterlife sitting in serpent venom. The ruler of hell is the death goddess Hela. Mistholm, or Niflheim, is a very cold realm lying to the north of the Nine Realms. It represents the element of fire and is the home of ice elementals and frost giants. The opposite of Mistholm is Muspelholm, or Muspelheim, the realm of fire, which is likewise the home of fire elementals and fire giants. The Outlands, or Utgard, is the unexplored outer regions of the earth. In the times of the Eddas, this was said to lie far to the east, but with our improved knowledge of the world today, it should be seen as a separate realm. The Outlands are home to the giants, who have much in common with the gods, and many gods have kin in the Outlands. Some of the giants are allies of the gods, and some are openly hostile. Thor is constantly making journeys to the Outlands to keep the hostile giants in check. The giants, especially the fire and frost giants, can be seen as climatic forces that threaten to upset the delicate balance in Middle-earth.
Alright, seems to cut off right there. You can tell how the descriptions of the nine worlds could correspond to the world created by Tolkien in the Lord of the Rings trilogy and in The Hobbit. And it's just pretty much laid out in his book, The Silmarillion. And there's much more that connects us. Not just that, well, they've got a realm called Midgard, or Middle-earth, which corresponds directly to the land where it's taking place there, but also other features, dwarfs that turn to stone, although they're called something else in the Lord of the Rings there. This be orcs or goblins. I think goblins, ones that turn to stone. Also, you know, the land of fire, which would be Mordor. It sounds a lot like murder. Also, there is the Ring trilogy and the part two of the Ring series of Wagner, which is based upon Volsunga Saga and the Poetic Edda. So that was known as the Ring, or Der Ring des Nibelungen. And Wagner's opera was four nights long and totaling about 15 hours. So this was epic. It's probably the same amount of time it would take to watch all of the director's cuts of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Also, tying together the Lord of the Rings and The Ring would be Sméagol murdering his cousin Deagle to get the ring, which was in the traditional tale, Fafnir murdering Fasolt, and they were giants. Siegfried comes from the ring. He is the grandson of Wotan, and he slays Fafnir to himself only be slayed in the process. I'm not going to recount the whole story there because I don't know it all, and it obviously is long. Tolkien said of the comparisons that both rings were round, and there the resemblance ceases. So he was saying he didn't base it upon the ring, but it seems somewhat obvious that he did. It was a story about a ring that was forged that would allow for control, domination of the world. The two stories were similar. And Tolkien had been writing somewhat about Germany in the Second World War. That's when The Lord of the Rings was penned. He himself had fought against Germany in World War I, and his son fought against Germany in World War II. And he would correspond with him and write him stories while he was away at war. So these wars had a very big effect upon Tolkien. And although he was drawing upon ancient legends, perhaps in some ways he was trying to basically propagandize against the axis of evil in Europe, which he saw centered around the finger of Hitler. So a short reading here from NationalGeographic.com, actually, about the influences of Tolkien. World War I and World War II. World War I broke out while Tolkien was a student at Oxford University. After finishing his degree, Tolkien joined the Lancashire Fusiliers as a second lieutenant. In 1916, Tolkien was sent to France. His fellow soldiers faced the terrifying new mechanisms of modern warfare, machine guns, tanks, and poison gas, fighting in some of the bloodiest battles known to human history. Tolkien fought in the Battle of the Somme, a vicious engagement in which over a million people were either killed or wounded. Wow. In the trenches of World War I, Tolkien began recording the horror of war that would later surface in The Lord of the Rings. Later that year, he caught trench fever, an illness carried by lice, and was sent back to England. During his convalescence, he began writing stories and the mythology of Middle-earth, which would form the basis for The Silmarillion. An author cannot, of course, remain wholly unaffected by his experience, Tolkien acknowledged, but he strongly denied that his story was an allegory for World War I or II. Although The Lord of the Rings was written during World War II and follows the rise of a great evil threatening to envelop the world, the ring was not meant to symbolize the atomic bomb. Likewise, the characters Sauron and Saruman, although both tyrants, are imaginary characters and not meant to represent Hitler or Stalin. As Professor, are they trying to imply that Hitler were cohorts there? Interesting. As Professor Daniel Timmons notes, the beginnings, the processes, and the ends of The Lord of the Rings and World War II are wholly different. In the foreword to the second edition of Lord of the Rings, Tolkien wrote, By 1918, all but one of my close friends were dead. The reader cannot help but notice that the marshes of mortar is eerily reminiscent of World War I's Western Front and its utter devastation of life. So, let's talk about Mordor. In Mordor, there is that seeing eye. I guess it's not all seeing because its power is not yet complete, but it can see a lot. And this is obviously something, you know, we've been familiar with in recent years. As soon as you get into the conspiracy, they'll show you the all-seeing eye above the pyramid. And interestingly enough, it was said that the Cyclopes, you know, the giant Cyclops race, were the ones who built the pyramids. They had, you know, one eye, and the pyramids are topped with just one eye. Was it talking perhaps about a people who would have awakened the third eye, perhaps were able to utilize their powers in incredible ways? The ancient Aryans obviously knew about the third eye, and which is why you will see dots over the third eye in India to this day. Eye for an eye. Apple of my eye. There is even a little eye above the lowercase I. And it is what I call myself. In the English alphabet, I equals 9. 9, huh? 9 principles of Asatru. On the last show, Dave and I talked about the order of the 9 angles, or angels, it could be. Angels, very close. There's a reason for that. And I played some audio about the 9 worlds. Odin hung upside down for 9 days and 9 nights. In the Lord of the Rings, there are 9 ringwraiths who were once formerly kings. So I equals 9. That number associated with Odin, and Odin was said to have lost his eye. On the last show, I discussed how in the magic square of the sun, which totals up to 666, if you take any 4 numbers that form the corners of a square or rectangle within that matrix, that the corners of that square or a rectangle will equal up to 74. 74 GD, the value of the words Lucifer, Jesus, English, gematria. This is what we're doing. We're actually doing simple English gematria. And each one of those words, simple English and gematria, all add up to 74. Masonic, 74. Jewish, 74. Occult, 74. Ruler, 74. Messiah, 74. It can go on and on. There are many important words that add up to 74. Even a very popular spelling of Muhammad, equals up to 74. So where am I going with this? 666 tied in with 74, which is this kind of savior number. Yeah. Well, if you take 74 and multiply by 9, you get 666. 74 times 9 equals 666. Or if we translate that just into letters, GD I equals 666. God times I equals 666. So that I atop the tower in the land of the volcano, what really representing? Seems to be representing Vulcan, otherwise known as Vulcain. Vulcan was cast out of Olympus for being born redheaded. Much like Cain was cast out. Vulcain would then find a coal on a beach, bring it down into kind of an underground realm, and he would start a large fire and eventually a great forge from which he would make many armaments and even robots, it was said. It's an interesting story there of Vulcain, who trapped Hera in a magical throne contraption and was thus promised to Venus, so he would let her go. He relates to the alchemist Tubal Cain. You see statues of him, Masonic guy there. But his name is very, well, representative of the male genitals. Tubal Cain, Tubal Cain. If you look at the symbol for Tubal Cain, it actually is the 007 symbol right there. So search that out if you want. Tubal Cain. Yes, Cain. Cain was said by some to be the son of the serpent. Eve's son there, that evil Eve producing Cain. God wanted Cain and Abel to sacrifice to him. So Abel sacrificed what was dear to him, what he was doing, which was raising animals. He sacrificed the bloody flesh to God, and that pleased God. When Cain sacrificed, I don't know, was it sugar cane or some kind of cane, vegetable, corn, maybe? When Cain sacrificed some plants to that God was not pleased. So Cain sacrificed what was the meat that was near and dear to him to please God. His beloved brother. Oh, God, you want some meat to please you? Seems that Abel is a good choice. There's also a very esoteric reading to this, too, and I will have to credit Dennis Fecho for this one. And that would be basically the battle between 1 and 9, Abel and Cain. So the A actually represents a bull in Hebrew, in their language system, in the runes. The first is Feo, Fehurst. Feo is a cow. And just take the A of our alphabet and turn it upside down, and you will see that it is really representing a head of cattle. Two horns in the air. So A is the bull, and I is the cane. The nine. This is the beginning and the end. And at the top, if you were to count up from our numbers, and we really only have arguably 10, 0, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. It starts over again with 10, 1, and 0. So at the top is 9. At the top of this cane of sorts is 9, which is the eye. So if you think about an obelisk, the eye is at the top if you were counting up. This is not a countdown. So I have some other theories that will perhaps tie in Middle Earth to the land of the Middle East, whence the Semitic religions came, and I will be looking into those further on the other side as well. But for right now, I am going to go to a song. I think you might recognize it. Mm-hmm. Middle Earth could also relate to Hollow Earth and Agartha and Shambhala. A few shows ago, I did some thinking on those subjects and some readings, so please do check out the archives to learn a little bit more about that. But right now, I want to talk about Middle Earth as possibly the Middle East. And let's keep this discussion tied into Cain. And the Cain. But first, we'd have to discuss Canaan. And Canaan was one of Noah's grandsons, the son of Ham. And Canaan was cursed with perpetual slavery. And the reason this curse was placed upon him is because Ham looked upon his father, Noah, drunk and naked. So, because of that, Ham's son, Canaan, I guess, was cursed into eternity, and all of his descendants later on. This is known as the Curse of Ham, and the way that people who claim to be the real people of Israel, whoever that might be, will justify slavery. Oh, it's the Curse of Ham. They deserve to be slaves. The lands of Canaan were promised to Abraham. And Yahweh eventually delivered Canaan to the Israelites. Now, Canaan is basically where Israel is today, but more. It's a little bit disputed, but in general, that area was known as Canaan. And just as Cain and Canaan are cursed, the Bible is a little bit confusing because somewhat stand in for each other, and genealogically speaking, sometimes you'll see the same figure being, you know, basically his own grandfather sometimes, or very similar name to make the story work, make the genealogies work for them. It's all very convoluted. It really is, and it's very backward in many regards. I guess the problem with the Canaanites in particular is that the Israelites themselves, though they conquered the Canaanites, were themselves, in fact, Canaanites, or at least referred to as such for some time. It was Joshua who led the Israelites into their promised land and killed off many of the people that were living there first. But there were still some Philistines who survived and offered some resistance. Canaanite actually began to be known as merchant as well. Something of an inside joke to refer to Jews as merchants. Those were the Canaanites. In Canaan, or Phoenicia, are very much similar, but not exactly the same, were the cities of Byblos, from whence we get the Bible. Byblos also meaning book. And Phoenician tying into phonetics, right? But also another interesting name of a Phoenician or Canaanite city would be Tyre. T-Y-R-E. Tyre, like the Norse proto-god. That was said to have been built, these cities, Byblos and Tyre, said to be built under the reign of Cronus, or Saturn. Makes me also think back to Asatru. Asatru. Just put an N on the end, and you've got a Saturn in something of an anagram form there. Could it be related? Maybe. Asatru. Canaan. This place was in between a lot of important empires, and still is. The Egyptian, Hittite empires, and the Assyrian empires, they all kind of met in Canaan. So this was very much a land of mixing. So the people themselves were called Canaanites, but also anybody that was really occupying the land came Canaanites. And it was hard to distinguish the people from the land in some regards. Who are really the Canaanites? It's almost just a question. It's irrelevant in some regards, but I'll be getting into a little bit more later concerning the Semitic and Indo-European influences in the area. So as this land amidst other empires, these people must have felt that there were growing threats right outside their borders. kind of like the people of the West in The Lord of the Rings. At one time, the Canaanites were right next to the Akkadian Empire, quickly taking in Sumerian city-states. One particular ruler comes to mind and might connect us to the Lord of the Rings epic there. That would be Sargon, much like Sauron. Sargon is an Assyrian name. I guess it was originally Sarukin, which in Akkadian means the true king or the legitimate king. And which makes me think of Saturn again, the real Lord of the Rings. Sargon, the great king, was Semitic. Semitic empire, who conquered many Sumerian city-states around the time of the 23rd and 22nd centuries BC. He had a multi-ethnic, kind of a multicultural empire ruled centrally. And if you look on Wikipedia for Sargon of Akkad, you will see a bust, which they are saying is Sargon. And lo and behold, one of his eyes has been busted out. So he's really only got one eye. Huh, that's interesting. He kept the religious institutions of Sumer. And these were the religions that the Semites were pretty much using at that time. And Sargon was saying he was a representative of Anu, or basically an emissary of Enlil. Another important ruler around the Canaanites would be the emperor known as Hammurabi. Hammurabi. You noticed a lot of Hams coming up. You know, Abraham, the curse of Ham, Hammurabi. He was the one who first found the Babylonian Empire. His name is Amorite, which is pretty much Canaanite, if my understanding is correct. And the Babylonian law was credited with being one of the first laws. It preceded the Babylonian Talmud, if their records are correct. And in the code of Hammurabi, you can find things like eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Huh. Eye for eye. Well, you know, in The Lord of the Rings, they have the two towers, right? There is the ivory tower with something of an eye above that. And then there is Sauron's tower with an eye above that. And both are really seeking to realize their true king, bring him back to the throne and conquer. Let us get on with the religion of Canaan. Information is coming from Crystal Links. Not saying that they're always correct or a great source, but I check in with them sometimes to read up on these things. There aren't a whole lot of great sources available to us these days. In any event, the chief deity of the pantheon of the Canaanites was the father god, and his name was El. He was a fertility god, often seen as a bull god, something of a good and loving god. He was known as the kindly and compassionate, much like Allah the merciful, the compassionate in Islam. But El was capable of anger, if his people transgressed against him, if this community was going astray, he could be provoked. And he would actually prompt other neighboring powers to invade and conquer Canaan. And so as to avoid having such calamities befall them, the king would have to perform rites of expiation and offer sacrifices to El. Seems that their deities were also based upon the natural features of their particular environment. In Canaan, they had coastal towns and the agrarian hinterland, much like we have in America, and there is a great divide between them. But this is illustrated in the Canaanite mythology as the struggle between the storm god, variously called Teshub, Horion, or Baal Hadad, and that would be the Semitic, Amorite, or Aramean name, against Yah, Yah, Yao, Yahu, or Yam, god of the sea and rivers. So Baal, the storm god, versus Yah, or Yahu, the god of the seas and rivers. Interestingly, Yahweh is something of a storm god, so it seems like it was reversed a bit. And Baal, B-A-L, was fighting against El. Pretty much it was the same as Jupiter versus Saturn, or Zeus versus Cronus, and involved the castration of El by the younger Baal, who was going ballistic and running amok. The underworld god of the Canaanites was Mot, M-O-T. And anybody who studied Egyptian mythology would know that the Egyptian underworld ruler is Maat, M-A-A-T. So exactly the same name there. But whereas it was Osiris in Egyptian mythology who was killed and dismembered, in the Canaanite mythology here, it was Maat who was killed and dismembered by Anath, which was Baal's consort. Like Osiris was killed by Set, as I said. And interestingly enough, if you look back further in time, Isis, Osiris's consort, was known as Aset, A-S-E-T. And Set was later claimed to be Osiris's brother. So, as I said, these things kind of get mixed up over time. Anat, the consort of Baal, becomes something like Kali, relishing in the blood of the slain, having severed heads adorning her. In any event, Mot is revived, and Shapash, which is basically a female sun deity, intervenes in the war between Mot and Baal. So because of Shapash's intervention, Baal rules during the fertility season, while Mot rules during the sterile season and the drought. I said Shapash before as the female sun deity. Well, if you go to the Mesopotamian mythology, you have Shamash, who is the male sun deity. So Shapash the female, and right around the corner, you have Shamash the male, serving a similar function. A quick note, the people in current-day Philistine, the Palestinians, have Hamas, which is just missing an S at the beginning to have Shamash. Shamash. I don't know how to say that, really. The story I just told about Mot and Baal taking different times of the season seems very similar to me to the story of Adonis in Greek, or Adonai, which means Lord in Hebrew, who was beloved by Persephone and also Aphrodite. And everybody was pretty much jealous of Adonis. He was a very beautiful hunter. And so Aphrodite sheltered him. He had a very strange birth. It was incestuous as well. A king being tricked into impregnating his daughter. Very, very strange stuff there. In any event, Adonis was sheltered and then entrusted to Persephone, but she didn't want to give him back. So the goddesses have a dispute, which is settled by Zeus, and that, or rather, Calliope on Zeus's behalf. And the decision was that Adonis had to spend one third of every year with each goddess, and then the last third wherever he would choose. And so he would always choose to spend one third with Persephone down there in the underworld, and then two thirds of the year with Aphrodite, the beautiful goddess. Makes you think of maybe living in the Caribbean or something, choosing to have the fertility for two thirds of the year rather than one third, which would be what it would be like up in the Norse North. So this sharing arrangement went on until his death. And Adonis was killed by a wild boar, which was said to have been sent by Artemis, who he offended. Wild boar, Ham, there you go. And in some stories, it wasn't Artemis who killed Adonis, but rather Aphrodite's lover, Ares, who became jealous of Adonis. Also, Apollo has been held responsible for this because his progeny, Erymanthus, had looked upon Aphrodite in the nude, and Aphrodite blinded him for it. Makes me think of Noah being seen in the nude and cursing someone for it. Or Isis not wanting to be seen unveiled, perhaps. So, this is starting to become a little convoluted, a little interwoven, turned around in certain regards. How do you make heads from tails? It's rather hard, and I'm just basically putting this material out there, hopefully so that you will have some new neural connections. Looks like we're running out of time here in the live stream. I'm going to go just a little bit into the archives and finish up with some notes here. So please do check this out after I have finished. I'll leave a note in the chat and you'll be able to download shortly after that. Thank you all so much for tuning in live with me here tonight. I really do appreciate your interest in this show and your support of it. As always, please do other shows here on Renegade Broadcasting. So, why is there something of an intermixing between European, pagan, and Semitic beliefs? Sharing of some names and stories. Does it have anything to do with Kabbalah? Well, maybe. And in this area, you will see an intermixing of people. People speaking Indo-European and others speaking Semitic languages. The Hittites spoke an Indo-European language. And the Philistines were not really Canaanites, or so it seems. And that would be why Goliath, the Gaul Goliath, was slain by the Semitic David. There was a conflict going on. And the tall people, the European people, seem to have lost some land, lost some area at a certain point, and been beat back by the Semites. Oh, another little quote quickly from Crystal Links. There is some uncertainty about whether the name Canaan refers to a specific Semitic ethnic group wherever they live, the homeland of this ethnic group, or a region under the control of this ethnic group, or perhaps any of the three. Reminds me very much of the current day Hebrews and the claims over being the people of Israel. Are they a religion? Are they a land? Are they Are they a race? What is this? What's going on here? So, the people worshipped Baal for quite some time. And this deity is often associated with Bel, which makes a whole lot of sense, because it's very phonetically similar. But Bel was the Celtic god, which is why we have Beltane, right? But let's look at the story of Abel and Cain just one more time with this in mind. Abel versus Cain. Also, just consider other words that contain Bel, like belief, right? Rebel. There's a lot. There's a lot there. Back to the Celtic sun god for a moment. Bel or Belenos means the shining god. He was often seen as being depicted with a horse and wheel. Those are his symbols. Much like the sun god Apollo, who was drawn by a chariot consisting of horse and wheels. Horus, right? Horus being drawn by horses. Bel was actually the most widespread Celtic deity, covering the most land. So you'd find different derivations of this deity. In Gauleth mythology, Belisnus's consort was a goddess known as Belisama. 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 W. H. D. Rouse wrote in 1940 an endnote to Book 40 of his edition of Nonus Dionysicus Dionysica. No, I didn't say that correctly. Guard, this is what the quote was. The Greeks were as firmly convinced as many modern Bible readers that the Semites, or the Orientals generally, worshipped a god called Baal, or Bel. The truth, of course, being that Baal is a Semitic word for lord or master, and so applies to a multitude of gods. This Bel, then being an important deity, must be the sun. The more so as some of the gods bearing that title may have been really solar. And I know this might be used to further the claims of Christian identity, but I don't think that is the way that you need to read it. Who likes to steal the most? Who does it to this day? Who has been appropriating other people's mythologies to their own ends? Really, who are the creative people and who are not? I think we can all agree that today those claiming to be the chosen ones are very deserving of any kind of special status. And you'd really have to question what kind of God would choose them and what they'd be chosen for. The deity Bel is named in the Bible. Isaiah 46:1, Jeremiah 50:2, and Jeremiah 51:44. Let me just quickly run through a few more words that have Bel right there in it. One would be the belly, right there. You're right near your solar plexus, right near that. You will put a belt around your belly, and when you were young, if you lived a little bit longer ago than I did, you might have had a dinner bell rung when your belly was rumbling. They also hang bells around cows' necks often. Cows. Beef, it's what's for dinner. After dinner, you might belch and feel like you belong to something important. A family, kin. Let me go further with this this idea of the cow and how it relates. I talked about the primal cow of El, and also Fehu. That ties in actually with Adhumla, which is the primal cow in Norse mythology, who licked the cubic block of life containing the progenitor of humankind. So the cow is represented in astrology as Taurus, T-A-U-R-U-S. Taurus, or just T-A-U-R, tower, is said as phonetically, as tower. I was talking about the two towers before, right? There was the Tower of Babel, famously in the Semitic mythology. Tower of Babylon. The very, seen as the original city constructed by that famous hunter, Nimrod. Babel breaks apart in many interesting ways. Babel, the beginning of El. Abel, spelled just as Abel in the story of Cain and Abel. And babbling is something that I tend to be all right at babbling on, rambling on. And right in the middle of Babel, you have Abe. Abe as in honest Abe. Abraham, the great father deity of both the Semitic religions and the United States. Oh, great Abe Lincoln, saving the Union. Abel, Abe-El, right? Abe-El was killed. He has a monument. From his monument, a reflecting pool in Washington, to the Washington Monument. The Washington Monument. I will get into that just briefly here. It's 555 feet from the ground to the top. 555 feet is 6,660 inches. 6660. It's interesting. Actually, there is an extra 111 feet below the surface. So that would make it 666 feet total. So 555 and 666 playing a very important part right there in Washington. Interestingly enough, if you're to make cubes out of these triplets, which is what I do when I see triplets, if you multiply 5 times 5 times 5, you get 125. 1 to 5 is directly to A-B-E. Abe. All right, so Abe is looking out at a 555-foot Washington Monument there, and 5 times 5 times 5 equals A-B-E, 125. Washington has been portrayed as Baphomet, famously. Right? And the Washington Monument is 6,660 inches, or you could say it's 666 feet from buried bottom to top. So let's multiply 6 times 6 times 6. It is 216. 6 times 6 times 6 is 216, which is B-A-F, Washington as Baphomet. I think that it's too much to just be coincidence. So I mentioned that 5 times 5 times 5 is 125, but 125 can also be translated out back into letters as 1 and 25, A and Y, which are atop the rainbow alphabet. I won't get into the rainbow alphabet in detail here, but it's an interesting connection because Well, we're talking about the Rainbow Bridge before, and trying to take something of a comprehensive look at these different mythologies and how they might have been incorporated into the English alphabet. So, AY can also be translated as ABE, I and Abe. And interestingly, let's just try 8 times 8 times 8. That's another good triplet to consider. 888 is the value of Jesus in Greek. It's also found somewhat in the runes, because the Anglo-Saxon Futhorc has a tier of 8, a tier of 8, and another tier of 8, making 3 A-tier for a total of 24. 888. Okay, 8 times 8 times 8 is 512. 512 is, in English, E-L. L. Okay? Now, I was talking about how the Canaanites had El as the father god. Election, electricity. Right? Elohim. Elevation. You are the ends of words as well. It's everywhere. Yell. 8 times 8 times 8 equals L. 888 plus 888 equals 1776. 1776. So 888 plus 888 equals 1776. These are numeric coding. I know not everybody is into this stuff, so that's why I put it at the end. So if you're not interested, you know, you don't have to listen. I really enjoy this type of material, so I do like to put it out there to try to pique some people's interests. David Lane writes some interesting material here that I will tie in. You can find this at davidlane1488.com. In the case of Revelation 13:18, we find it has 125 letters as we count the number of the beast. A three-digit number can be scrambled 6 possible ways. When the letters are added together, the result will be a multiple of 111, and thus a multiple of the columns of the 666 sun square. The number 125 scrambles into 122, 215, 251, 512, and 521. By the way, I just mentioned that 512 there. Add the 6 together, and the result is 1776, the date of the American Revolution, the birth of the beast. Whether the numbers are a coincidence, prophecy, or a coded plan, I leave to the reader to speculate. So he mentioned that Revelation 13:18 had 125 letters, and I just mentioned before that 5 times 5 times 5 equals 125, which can be read as Abe, or AY, I, which is the eye of the rainbow alphabet, which you can find at the sidebar of startheory.wordpress.com. I found this 125 there in an interesting place. I was looking at the letters of my name, Kyle. K is 11, Y is 25, L is 12, and E is 5. So my name is 1, 1, 2, 5, 1, 2, 5. Interesting. 1 and then 125. In a different part, David Lane goes on to say, 125 represents 1-25, or January 25th, the conception date of the man. And he's referring to himself there. On January 25th, 1938, the entire northern hemisphere experienced the most spectacular display of the Aurora Borealis, northern lights, in recorded human history. This can be confirmed in the newspaper archives from that period. Precisely 280 days later, the human gestation period, the man of the prophecy was born, November 2nd, 1938, in a town called Woden, in the state of Iowa, USA. So, let me quickly try to wrap this up in some crazy fashion with a little bit more of the esoterics, the examination of the language. El was often seen with Atheroth, like Astaroth, as the sea goddess. And she would be wearing a Hathor headdress. Now, Hathor, the Egyptian goddess, is a cow goddess. Right, the cow tying in again. But her name is Hathor. Ha-Thor. You know, you can find our words like author also containing the god Thor. Let me think here. Oh, yes. Canaan. It's spelled C-A-N-A-A-N. Ka-Nan. Now, if we go back to the ancient Aryans, they were in India for some time. And in India, they had Nandi, who was the mount of Shiva. Shiva's bull, his steed. And Nandi is an anagram of Inda, or rather, I Nandi is an anagram of Indian. And in India, naan is bread. And in Europe, pan or pawn is bread, like panera or panini. And in Christianity, Jesus is bread. Oh, the Bible. A bunch of bullshit, huh? Canaan. Does it tie in? Well, Canaan was the bread basket, was it not? I'm just playing around here, and hopefully you can either, you know, consider these coincidences, or and reject them, find them interesting, or maybe you find that there's something to it. Cana later became Phoenix, as it is recorded. Cana became Phoenix. In some ways, I feel like the Canaanites, who are often labeled by Christian identity, CI, which I think stands for confidential informant. CI, the confidential informants, say that the Canaanites are really the Jews and the Aryans are the Israelites, which doesn't really seem to work too much for the way I see it, though some Canaanites look rather Semitic and, you know, have really big noses. Yeah, they look like Jews. I think that Cana or Phoenicia had to move, much like when Troy was destroyed by their cousins across the way, they had to flee. And it seems they went up to Europe. Well, I think perhaps after Goliath was defeated by David, the Phoenicians had to flee and would later rise up again as a strong force, as a phoenix. Now, today, we have John McCain, who was dubbed the Phoenix from Arizona when he ran against Barack Obama. What a disgrace that guy is. Yeah. He's more like Cain's pickles. I don't know if you ever had those. And I'm just saying that McCain is kosher. I don't know really, truly, what happened back then because I wasn't around. So all I'm trying to do is be a linguistic archaeologist, looking at the artifacts of our past and trying to figure things out, because you get some really contradictory, confusing tales if you're going to look into, well, the Bible for sure, but then other documents from the time. It's really hard to figure out what's going on. So I think that this is a good pursuit. We shouldn't be afraid of looking at certain things because it might correspond in some way to what the confidential informants of CI are up to. Because there's a lot to learn from an examination of the language and looking at the people of these periods. For example, the Amorites were a Canaanite people. And if you reverse Amor, the beginning of their name there, you get Roma. Did that phoenix later rise in Rome? Rome had a great deal of influence in the lands of Canaan as well. So, to conclude, I would have to say we should very much focus on the values of our people in the past. Look at what some others believed as well, and try to find what really works for us moving forward. I mentioned a decent amount about my feelings regarding Osatru, and let other people talk about it as well, because, well, they are a little bit more involved with it than I am. I thought it was good to have their perspectives, and I hope you enjoyed that as well. And when we're getting into this material, let us not let the mainstream media or even the alternative media define how we see things. Of course they're going to try. They're going to try to subvert our natural tendencies, our desires, our aspirations, divert them. That's why there are games like Dungeons and Dragons and video games like Skyrim or the Vikings show on TV. And none of this is intended to get us to actually embody the principles of our gods, to become like the gods, to be in communion with the gods, to not be kneeling down before them, but being empowered by them, with them, for them. For us to be protecting our kinsfolk, protecting our culture, and making this world the place it ought to be. And with that, my dear folk, I will say good night. Thank you all so much for tuning in once again, and stay tuned to Renegade Broadcasting for much more.
depende kakendel fly ur fiatla gyose fly ur fiatla gyose.